Good evening, everyone. Visitor tonight?
Yes.
Welcome to Yacht Prachi.
Yeah.
He's super. Why don't we do introductions around so you hear the names?
I'm Ellie.
I'm Ben.
Ross.
Yeah.
Kari.
Steve.
Marie.
I'm Ritha Shu.
Paul.
Jeffrey.
Ron.
Nico.
Judy.
Mustin.
Violet.
Well, I know when I walked in, everybody was curious about this package that came for me and suddenly appeared in the middle of our sendo. So I should tell you that it's the libretto of the opera that was composed and performed in Santa Fe Opera about Steve Jobs and my teacher, Coben. So it doesn't give the music, unfortunately. I wish the music came with it. It's just the words. But Coben is, I just read the last page where he's reciting what we just recited, the end of the Heart Sutra. So, Zei Dai Jinshu, Zei Dai Myoshu, surpassed complete perfect enlightenment. And there's reference to his having drowned. So it sounds very interesting and very weird to me. Everything can be made into a story. And it may live for a long time. So we are on the part of the third noble truth. There were four of them: the truth of suffering, the truth that our suffering is based on our ignorance of how things really are, and our greed and desire to keep things fixed in place and not to change, and our refusal to notice that we're part of a big, huge picture. And the third noble truth is called the truth of cessation, which is a kind of a funny English word. It's the truth of stopping or ending. It describes, Buddha described how the whole process of clinging to what causes our suffering can end. That there is a possibility of, he says, blowing out the flame. That we keep this flame going and relish it and believe that we're a permanent kind of condition in the world, and that the world itself is a permanent kind of condition. And the truth is, none of it is permanent. It is all so transitory. All coming and going, just like that. We ourselves are coming and going like that, day by day, from beginning to end. This, as I always say, is a Tibetan version of this third noble truth now. And the Tibetans base all their teachings on Nagarjuna, who reasoned carefully about the truth of things. And so there's a very deep reasoning going on into this one that Shakyamuni Buddha didn't really know about. What Buddha said was, it can stop, and it will stop if you stop clinging to yourself and let things go. But in this teaching, there's a great deal more. He said we must ask ourselves, what's nirvana? What's liberation? What do we mean by cessation? Is it possible to end things? Is it possible to have cessation or not? So this reasoning goes like this. In Buddhism, we assert that one category of phenomena manifest to us and are perceived directly. So we don't need to prove that this is a book. We can see it, bam, just like that. A second category may not be so obvious to us. But we can infer their existence through a process of reasoning. These are known as slightly obscure phenomena. Emptiness belongs to this category. So emptiness is this notion that rises up in always in our practice. We say form doesn't differ from emptiness. Emptiness doesn't differ from form with that. What the heck is emptiness? He said we can infer the truth of emptiness, and we can reason that liberation is possible also. True understanding of liberation should be based on understanding of emptiness, because liberation is nothing other than the total elimination or total cessation of delusion and suffering through insight into emptiness. So once we understand what emptiness is already, we've seen through our delusions. It seems that our acceptance of liberation as a possibility is a function of how well we understand the concept of emptiness, says Dalai Lama. So then there are four interpretations of no self or emptiness. According to the scriptures, emptiness is an absence of the object of negation. If you say that, let's go back to this example. Let's imagine that I have a certain fear based on some kind of suspicion that there might be something threatening nearby. If the thought occurs to me that I may be mistaken, that it may be my projection, then although it will lessen my fear, it will not completely dispel it. However, if instead I develop the thought that it is pure and utter illusion, that there isn't anything there at all, and I'm just imagining it, and if my negation is that categorical, then of course it will have an immediate impact on dispelling my fear. Oh, I'm just making it up. There's nothing there. So according to the scriptures, emptiness in this example is the absence of the object of negation. Our thought is the object. And it's just a thought, there's nothing there. So there's we have to go further then and try to understand what the object of it actually is. And this is how we understand what self is in the context of no self. So this is a big question that comes up always in Zen practice. We talk about dropping the self, or studying the self, or trying to find the self and put your finger on it someplace. And if you look and look, you can't find it, even though you kind of know it's there. So there are different ways of knowing about no self. And I don't think we have to even know about that. There are several interpretations of what's real and eternal. Is there a real eternal soul? And he says there are schools that say yes, there is. And that's the self. This is what is lasting forever. Even though I die, my soul will continue in some kind of way. And then there, as we know, there, depending on what our belief system is, there are all kinds of ways of explaining that. But there are others who say, well, no, it's just a thought. There is no soul, there is no self at all. And that's the mind-only school. And then there is the school that is basically ours, the Madhyamaka, which is the understanding of emptiness as things come into being as a result of causes and conditions. And although they're existing in one sense, in another, they're depending on our experience of them. As long as we haven't deconstructed or dismantled the notion that things and events have some kind of existence, we're still grasping at things as real. Once we understand, not that there isn't anything, but that it's just an accumulation of stuff. It's bits and pieces that are all put together that make a book, that make a flower, that make a person, that make anything. And all those bits and pieces don't remain, but are going as soon as they come. And what holds them together we call life. And so in some sense, everything is real. It is real, but not real in a permanent way. Not real in a way that you can hold on to or own. And that if you're wise and insightful, you can see through. So that when you are stricken by emotion, you can begin to see that that too, the powerful feelings that take us over and become the source of our suffering. Poor me, why is this happening to me? This is terrible. But if we can see that it's one of the many causes and conditions that has come and will go again, that it's a mystery. And yet it's as real as we know it is at the same time. And Buddha said we can stop believing in things in the way that keeps us suffering. Just stop clinging to things as if they're not going to change. Stop being disappointed when things turn out another way. In fact, I always say the best way is just to be surprised. Just to set our mind in a curious mode, to see what's going to happen next and be willing to be surprised rather than devastated every time something happens, including old age and death, including sickness and terrible disappointment. We get clobbered by things when we don't have to be. In fact, we need the clarity that comes with this kind of insight so that we know how to act, that we know how to wisely do whatever needs to be done rather than reacting all based on my poor self and how much I'm suffering about this. It's very, very simple, and it's so hard to maintain this kind of view. That's the view that is the first path, part of the path, is to be able to maintain this view as we navigate what is always a difficult and painful life. And be able to experience our pain without letting us knock us off our feet. If we're able to meet what comes, that enables us to do what has to be done, what's needed. And in that case, we can be of some help. We can see more clearly so we can be helpful and be willing to help because we're not trying to protect ourselves all the time. Because there's nothing to protect. It's coming and going, coming and going. And the more we hold on to what we think we are, we don't know what we are. The more we enact ourselves, we are surprised by thinking, by seeing, oh, did I say that? Did I do that? Look at that. Wow. Sometimes with approval and sometimes with some embarrassment. But really, we are just expressions of life in the universe. And the more free we are, the more liberated we are to express harmlessly, with friendliness and happiness, the happier we can be, which is what Dalai Lama is always promising. Be happy. How can we be happy? Well, see how transparent everything is. See how the leaves fall off the tree. The flower falls, the weeds come up. See what happens next. So in Buddha's teaching, it was, he didn't say very much. And this is the shortest chapter in the book. Because it's such a simple message. He did say a few more things that I starred that I'll share with you. The moral that we can draw from all of this is that the strong emotions which afflict our mind arise from a fundamental state of confusion, which leads us to apprehend things as real and existing independently. In conclusion, we know that afflictive emotions and thoughts have no valid basis, neither in our experience, nor in reality, nor in reason. your insight into the emptiness of things is not only grounded in reason, but also in experience. Your understanding of emptiness and your grasping as things as real are directly opposed to one another. So one cancels the other out. Since they're opposing forces, and given that one has valid grounding, whereas the other does not, the final conclusion we can draw is that the more we deepen our understanding of emptiness, and the greater the power of our insight becomes, the more we see through the deception of emotions, because indeed we come to realize that strong afflictive emotions and thoughts and their basis, which is ignorance, can be weakened, while insight into emptiness can be enhanced. So, he says, it is as if the capacity for unobstructive knowledge is there in our mind, but the defilements obscure and hinder it from being fully developed and expressed. Once our understanding of the mind is informed by the idea that the essential nature of mind is pure luminosity, and mere experience, or the sheer capacity to know, we can then conceive of the possibility of eliminating these afflictions completely. So sometimes the advice is just to let your light shine. Buddha's last instruction, be your own light. Liberation is characterized in terms of four features. The first feature describes it as the true cessation of the continuum of afflictions. According to the second feature, liberation is true peace, the state of total tranquility, where the individual has contained complete freedom from all defilements of the mind. It's described in the third feature as totally satisfying because one has reached ultimate satisfaction. And fourth, it's described as definite emergence, in the sense that one has definitely emerged from the process of unenlightened existence. So this isn't a waving a wand or pressing a button and something happens and then it's over and we're fine. This is a lifetime project. And in my experience, we go in and out of it. And sometimes we're total dunces and we don't get it at all. And if it's painful enough, often we will stop and start to examine it again and realize how far off we've become and go back to work to bring ourselves into alignment with the power that we are, the light that we already are, always. So that's the third truth. Any questions?
I had a comment. I've been reading, I just started to read, Why is why Buddhism is true, and he's taking the Four Noble Truths using evolutionary psychology. And so it's kind of interesting in the sense of, like, hunger and other urges are basically designed to produce a sense of dukkha or dissatisfaction, because if it didn't, you wouldn't go out and get your next meal.
Yes.
And so it's interesting to look at it from a we're almost designed to have this. And what he said is that when he understood this, it didn't help him, and that's what made him turn to Buddhism and meditation. But when you were reading, when you were talking, what occurred to me is that I don't really know what suffering is, nor do I really know what clinging is, in the sense of, I think most of my spiritual practice is more about, say, wanting things to look the way I want, you know, to get what I want out of life. And if it's not, like you say, I'm devastated or upset. But in some ways, it almost seems like I don't really look at suffering and ask myself, what's going on here? And what, you know, I mean, I've heard that distinction between suffering and pain. But do I really kind of know it in a deep way? And do I really know what clinging is?
Yes.
And I think the answer in all three of these, you know, do I know what suffering is? No. Do I know what clinging is? No. Do I know what emptiness is? No. Because most of the time, even when I'm meditating and stuff, it's like there's this veil, or you know, that I'm trying to do something that really doesn't have anything to do with these noble truths.
Yes.
So it's a little odd in a way.
Well, that's why Dogen advises a study of Buddhism as a study of the self, to really get to know the self, to know what's going on, because otherwise we're just on automatic. There's a difference between the desires that keep us alive for food, sleep, sex, shelter, and being known, and greed. And that's a wonderful description of the difference, because of course we're programmed to need to eat because we won't live long if we don't. But what we do with our with our need is turn it into a greedy desire for more of everything, bigger houses, more food, etc., etc. And that becomes the source of our suffering. So if we begin to examine that aspect of how our mind is working, do I really need this? Or am I just making myself crazy? And if I'm not getting something, is this a survival thing? Or maybe I'm just going off the deep end in some way. And often our desires get way in the way, our greed, of other people and how we relate to other people. Because then we relate with people only in what we can get from them. And we forget how to give. We forget the whole other side. That's wonderful. Thank you for telling us about that book. That's very cool. Amrita?
Well, listening to you, a lot of events have come up, especially when the Dalai Lama is affected, and when that one mountainside full of the Tibetan monks is being destroyed by the Chinese. That's just happening over the last few weeks. And I just thought about, you know, the suffering that they're going through right now, and what their practice is to deal with this.
Yes.
And you know, the deaths that have been incurred. And it's interesting to kind of like how they're dealing with this. Yeah. And the same thing, I you know, when our political turnover going on here, I was I tapped into the Buddhist community's newsletters, and they're all like, you know, like there's a feeding frenzy of energy of like, oh, you have to come be scared with me because, you know, this political thing that's happening with our, you know, mm-hmm. politics, and I'm going, what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
This should not be, you know, I don't want to feed on your suffering of your energy and making me scared of something that, you know, it's there, but, you know, we'll manage. We've done it in the past. So it's kind of like we feed each other this, you know, we grab as many people as we can to come and join our suffering together.
Oh, we do.
And it's like, it's pretty sad. But then, you know, I come to the point where when that happens to me, I sit
mm-hmm.
and I learn. And I know, you know, like the cessation of suffering sometimes is death, but it doesn't have to be a physical death. It's just to, like, you know, accept it, accept what's going on, and then just, for me, letting it kind of die so I can really be reborn again to what my intentions are and my purposes to where I'm sitting mm-hmm. and centering myself to make it stronger. Yeah, it's not that easy because, you know, then you get your own personal suffering going on too. And of course you die there too. But when you mentioned about it's like a delusion in our mind, like, am I making this up? Yeah. It kind of made me think about sometimes personally when you tell someone a story, they say, are you crazy? You know, like you know, that's all in your head. Of course, you take that personally and go, no, it's not true. It's happening to me. And then when you said that about like, oh, you know, it's all in our head. We should just, you know, it's not, doesn't really exist. I'm thinking part of me goes, yes, it does. It really does. And then part of me goes, yeah, it's true. I can let that, you know, I can handle it. So there's this game that goes on in our head sometimes, and it's, you know, when you finally figure it out, it is like that illusion, the delusion, and the ignorance of not knowing. But it's true. The only way, the only key to help you out is just to sit. And
just to sit down.
Put it right there in the center
yes.
of the ground and remind yourself again.
Yeah. It's thank you. Thank you. Good advice. Well, it's 8 o'clock. So I think that's it. We have announcements.
There's a half-day sit-in this Saturday, starting at 9 o'clock and ending at noon. And Wendy's going to open. She has a key, I think, yeah. And Violet's going to come and help her. Set up the room, so I will be here, so appreciate that.
Come if you can.
It's
always a nice mm-hmm. little piece of time. Quiet way to do a Saturday morning. Yeah. And it will be the beginning of our practice period. I did want to mention that as well. We'll have 6 weeks before our Sesshin. And so it's our tradition to have what we call a practice period where we sort of up the ante for ourselves in our practice. We sit more. We meet with each other if we can. We make sure to come to the Saturdays when we have a chance to do that and whatever else appears. Some people memorize things. Some people sew. If you're sewing, this is a chance to sew. And maybe even finish. It's just an opportunity to create more of a life of practice as we live our ordinary everyday life. And at the very end of Sesshin, after we've finished all of our sitting, we'll have a Shosan ceremony where you can sit like this and one by one come and challenge the teacher with a question. That's your dessert. So I have 1 minute sit.